most people don't wake up in the morning and say, how can we suppress women and people of color today?
The problem here is not that people are never rational, it's that we have the wrong definition of what it means to be rational.
Hey, Ashley.
Hey, Erin.
So we're talking about diversity, and I feel like before we go any further in this conversation, we have to tackle the idea of bias. I think part of the reason this conversation gets so thorny so quickly is that a lot of what underpins discrimination is mostly unconscious and unseen. The more we dig into the role neuroscience plays, the more I realize that we make all kinds of decisions without really being aware of why we're making a choice, or even sometimes that we're choosing at all.
Right. I mean, bias rules our lives, and we're not even aware of it. I recently learned that a team of researchers, one of whom's at Cambridge University and the other at Harvard, found that we humans make an average of 35,000 remotely conscious decisions every day. Researchers from Cornell University estimate that we make about 226 decisions a day about food alone.
Just 226? I feel like most of the decisions I make every day are based around food.
I know, right? We're making so many decisions every day. Those decisions have to be informed by something. And we're making all those choices, seemingly without thinking much about how we landed on them.
And that can be a good thing. We don't always have the time or energy to painstakingly analyze each decision we make. And from an evolutionary standpoint, it was literally a life and death issue. By the time you decide what that thing was following you in the woods, it was probably already trying to eat you. It's good then that we can make many of these decisions on autopilot. That's where instinct comes in. Only sometimes we can get ourselves into trouble, especially when our instincts steer us to assess a situation and assume we're making a rational decision when we're really not.
Sounds like it's time for us to talk about bias. I'm Ashley Marchand Orme.
And I'm Erin Essenmacher.
And this is Future Fluency,
the podcast where we explore the changing face of America through the lens of innovation, culture, and their impact on business, brought to you by the National Association of Corporate Directors.
Our own biases shape our perspective of the world, for better or for worse. But what is bias and how does it affect our decision making?
That's what we're going to dig into in this episode. I think it's important to start the conversation with a level set.
Level set is always good.
And Howard Ross is always good for a level set.
Some of you may remember Howard from episode one. He's done some interesting work in the diversity and inclusion space over the last few decades, and he certainly knows a thing or two about bias.
The first time I sat down with Howard, he shared a story about how his own unconscious assumptions colored his views.
I was coming back from a conference a couple months ago in Minneapolis and with my wife, who's one of my business partners and also one of our colleagues. And we get off the plane and we walk up out into the main at the national airport. We walk into the main, you know, part of the terminal, and there standing right in front of me, 25 feet in front of me, is Martin Luther King III, Dr. King's son. And I had one of these gobsmack moments, you know, these sort of celebrity moments or fanboy moments. So I went over to him very politely and I just shook his hand and said, you know, told him like so many thousands had that his father had deeply influenced my life. And couldn't have been more gracious. And I asked him if he would mind taking a picture. He was with his wife and another young woman. And it was lovely. And he and his wife and the three of us took a picture, and this other young woman took the picture, and we go home. And the next day I was sharing with somebody who was visiting us. Hey, yesterday we met Martin Luther King III, and he had his wife and his assistant with him. And my wife, Leslie, says, actually, she wasn't his assistant. She was his chief of staff. And I stopped and I thought to myself, wow, if that was a man, would I have assumed it was his assistant? You know, and the answer is probably no. And I know that I've done as much work on myself around this issue as probably any human being on the planet. And it's still there for me.
If someone like Howard, who literally spends his life fighting bias, is so vulnerable to this kind of thinking, it feels like there's no hope for any of us.
But that's what I love about this concept. If we start with the idea that we all have bias, then bias itself doesn't make us bad people. The work is trying to recognize, as Howard says, which flavor is ours and how it influences our behavior so we can do better.
I love what Laszlo Bock shared with you from his time at Google on how understanding unconscious bias was key to helping them unlock a major product issue.
Yes, and for our listeners, Laszlo is the former senior vice president of people at Google. More recently, he co-founded Humu, an organization that describes itself as driving behavioral change with the power of people science, machine learning, and love. Sounds right up our alley. Here's Laszlo.
When I was at Google, we had an experience where when we rolled out the uploader for YouTube for the iPhone. So how you get your videos off your iPhone onto YouTube. 10% of the videos were showing up upside down. And the team couldn't figure it out. They were checking for bugs, checking for some software issue, what was broken. And then somebody who was right-handed picked up their phone to shoot a video, and then while shooting it, switched it to their left hand. And what you do when that happens is you turn your phone upside down, because if you're left-handed, you hold your phone upside down relative to how a right-handed person does when you're taking it from the side of your head to shoot a video. And there weren't any left-handed people on the team. And that is an unconscious bias. Nobody thought of it.
Okay, so we know that these biases are the root of decision-making that affects everything from hiring decisions to product design to what we eat for lunch. But we know what you're thinking. If these decisions are unconscious, how can we see and understand them? We figured who better to help us unpack that than a neuroscientist.
That's where Lisa Feldman-Barrett comes in. She's a distinguished professor of psychology at Northeastern University, where she focuses on the study of emotion. Her book, How Emotions Are Made, questions some fundamental assumptions about how our brains work and how that affects the way we approach decision making.
We don't read each other. We make inferences. Our brains are inferring. They're just guessing all the time. And a lot of times our guesses are pretty good. Sometimes our guesses are pretty off base. But if we are, if the brain is guessing at a time when it's also having a very strong feeling, it's going to believe in the certainty of its guesses. We have demonstrated this in the lab time and time again, where unbeknownst to our test subject, we can make them feel pleasant or unpleasant, and they literally see a person as being more or less competent, more or less trustworthy, more or less honest, based on, this is a person they've never seen before, it's a snap judgment, it's a completely neutral face. They will actually see a face as smiling more or scowling more. It's a neutral face, right? Based on how we've manipulated their affect.
In your book, you talk about the concept of affective realism, and you say that if left unchecked, it can lead people to be dead certain and inflexible. So can you talk about what affective realism is and what you mean by that?
I wrote an article about affective realism in the New York Times with respect to guns, and that it's, you can see a gun that isn't there. But you see it. It's not like, but you literally see it. I mean, we can do this in the lab. We can very easily make people see guns that aren't there just by, you know, making them, increasing their affective experience to be more intense and putting a cell phone or a keys in the hands of usually a man. And if it's a man with dark skin, it's even easier because people, remember, the brain is trying to make sense of sensory inputs. So it sees, you know, it's taking in visual input. It's trying to make sense of that. And what have you learned? What have you learned by living in this country? You've learned, what have you learned by the television and by movies and by, you know, you've learned the base rate, the likelihood, whether or not it's really true in real life, you've learned that the base rate is that if somebody's holding something blurry and the person happens to be have dark skin, it's more likely to be a gun. And I should say, as I'm saying this, I'm not blaming anybody. Actually, police officers are like baseball players. If they waited to see, consciously confirm the presence of a gun, if that assailant had a gun, that officer would be dead. They can't wait, right? They have to go on their gut feeling. The problem is that what is their gut feeling? Like, where did that gut feeling come from?
Ashley, Lisa shared a powerful illustration of how this works in real life. It came from a response she got to her article in the New York Times.
After I wrote this article, this man wrote to me a very long, very gripping email about, you know, he had been in the Rhodesian army. He had actually been a lawyer in Rhodesia before, just around the fall of apartheid. And he was defending the guerrilla fighters, basically, who he saw as really freedom fighters. That was his take, right? This was a Rhodesian man, so he was a, you know, light-skinned guy. And then he was drafted into the Rhodesian military. So he had to start, become a militia, lead a militia against the people who he earlier had been represented in court. And one day he was in the forest with his troop, and up ahead he saw what he thought was a guerrilla fighter carrying an AK-47. And automatically he raised the gun, took aim at the, flipped the switch, took aim at the, you know, he was also carrying a machine gun, took aim at the guerrilla fighter, and was ready to shoot. And then he felt a hand on his shoulder, and someone else in the militia said to him quietly, "Don't shoot. It's just a boy." And the guy looked again, and it was a boy, a 12-year-old boy. And the guerrilla fighters, this you know, troop of guerrilla fighters, was a troop, was actually like a herd of cows. And, you know, the boy had a staff in his hand because he was like a shepherd boy. Now, and this guy lived with the guilt of having almost killed a boy for over 30 years because he really saw a guerrilla fighter. And he couldn't understand. He thought, well, maybe I have some lurking bias that I didn't know. And you know, for a lawyer to have a lurking bias, that's a problem. You know, the guy now lives in LA and has been here for years. But he, you know, lived with this whole life and didn't really understand how it was that he could, how could he see something that, you know, wasn't really there.
Well, on the one hand, I can see the case for sympathizing with the person who thinks they see a gun. But that's cold comfort for the person on the other end who's only holding their car keys. What informs our perceptions of people who are African American or darker skin that causes our brains to make these connections? That, I think, gets into the implicit biases we mentioned before, these messages that society and media send us that build up to these moments.
Exactly. And Dr. Feldman-Barrett also talked about how our misunderstandings around bias are rooted in part because some of the key research we have pointed to for years to understand the neuroscience of bias is wrong.
Hold on, what do you mean by wrong?
Well, for example, there are all these studies that scientists often point back to that measure activity in the amygdala, a little almond-shaped nucleus deep in the temporal lobe of the brain. These studies show activity in the amygdala increases when test subjects view African-American faces. The prevailing assumption has been this is a mark of implicit bias. There's just one problem with this. Here's Dr. Feldman-Barrett again.
The amygdala doesn't detect threat. It doesn't detect fear. It doesn't, it's not a fear. It doesn't, you know, compute fear. The amygdala's job is to alert the rest of the brain when something is novel, uncertain. Sort of like, we don't know what prediction to make here, so let's learn about this thing as much as we can so we can predict better the next time. So if you are living in most, in many parts of the U.S., you are not exposed to African-American dark faces on a regular basis, and they're more novel to you. And that's why you're going to have an increase in amygdala activity. If you are faced with a woman CEO and, you know, you start to feel a little unpleasant and jittery, it's not necessarily the case that you don't like her, don't trust her, it could be that you're just not familiar with having exposure to, so you don't know how to predict, right? What happens when you don't know how to predict? Your brain is going to, you don't have the past experience in order to predict well, or you predict and you predict wrong, you have an opportunity to learn, right? And that is to take in the information that you didn't predict so that then it's in there, it's in your brain, it's in your model of the world so that you can predict better next time. That's a really important part of the story, I think, that that really hasn't been told. But I think diversity and representation are important for other reasons. Younger people look to CEOs and politicians and professors and like leaders, basically. They are trying to imagine themselves in those roles, right? Which they can't do. Where does imagination come from? predictions. It's exactly the same, right? Your ability to imagine yourself, concretely imagine yourself in a rule is largely influenced by whether or not there's anyone who's similar to you in that role.
That's really interesting. So if you've never seen a female in the Oval Office, for example, and a woman runs for president, you might have a negative feeling about her, what Lisa referred to as nervous and jittery, which may have nothing to do with whether or not she's qualified. But you perceive the negative reaction as a reflection of her, not as an acknowledgement that your brain and body are processing new information.
Exactly. And it's particularly interesting because, as Lisa says, it starts to get to the heart of why representation matters. Diversity of thought is important to reach the best outcome. We don't want to just hire a woman or a person of color to check a box. But it's important that we see diverse types of people in leadership roles for another important and fundamental reason. It actually helps to retrain our brains to think differently about what a CEO or a board member looks like.
Erin, speaking of biases and similarities or dissimilarities, reminds me of a study I recently read about. Two researchers reviewed survey methods and experiments done on the topic of discrimination over the past 50 years or so. Their results were published in a peer-reviewed journal called American Psychologist, and they found that discrimination stems more from me favoring people who are like me than it stems from my hostility toward people different than me. Obviously, hostile prejudice still very much exists, but we might be less aware of how, even subconsciously, we discriminate by applying favoritism to people like us.
Right. Like Lisa says, it's just our brains making sense from patterns and information we already have. And if we've only ever seen a CEO who is white and male, then any other image can make us physically uncomfortable as the body reacts to the brain working overtime to see past that entrenched pattern. So the brain patterns can manifest as bias and then discrimination, but people aren't always conscious that they're doing this. It can all start to feel very chicken and egg. Howard and I talked a little bit about this. And so there's value in naming when bias happens, but I think what ends up happening is we go straight to you're a racist or you're a sexist versus, wow, that comment you made seemed like it was informed by racial bias.
That's right.
And that really becomes that's the environment versus making it personal, which immediately, I don't know anybody or very few people who, when you go straight to the personal, don't become immediately defensive and it shuts down the conversation.
Well, we know from studying the brain science behind this that when people think you're trying to fix them, it triggers activity in the dorsal insular area of the brain, which is associated with physical pain. Any of us who are in a relationship knows how well that works. You know, try to fix your partner, your spouse or friend and see how well that works. You know, immediately get defensiveness because the message is there's something wrong with you. There's something broken in you. And here, now I'm here. Here I am, in my saintliness here to fix you, So, I mean, it actually causes a dynamic that in psychology they call the backlash effect, which is I'll actually dig in deeper now. This is one of the challenges we have with our political discourse right now, is that we've moved from issue orientation, where I say to you, well, I disagree with you on gun rights. Let me tell you why, and let me hear your ideas about this, and let's see if we can come up with a solution. We've come up to that with you're one of those kind of people.
It makes sense to me that starting with let me help fix you doesn't work. So what does?
It all starts with the willingness to accept that we all have bias and then a willingness to become more aware of how those biases manifest. Here's Howard again.
Training that helps people understand the way they make decisions, the way their mind is making decisions, have actually found to be enormously effective. And because what it does is it helps us act more consistent with our values. It starts with the recognition that every decision we make is biased in some way. Having bias doesn't mean you're bad. It simply means you're human. Sometimes that's to our benefit. For example, if you're walking down a dark street and you hear some raucous noise that sounds like people are drunk and you hear bottles crashing or something in your brain says, this isn't safe, let me take a different route. That's appropriate. That's helpful. That's valuable. If when somebody is interviewing a potential candidate for a job, certain red flags come up. Let's say your organization's been going through a lot of turmoil over the last couple of years and you're really trying to create stability and you look at somebody's resume and it says 10 jobs in 12 years, well, that's a good bias to have. That's a helpful bias to have. This might not be the best person for us to have here. At least let me check out whether that pattern is going to change. At least it makes me alert. On the other hand, we know it can lead to people being shot innocent people being shot by police officers. So it can go the whole gamut between these kinds of things. So if we recognize that we have bias and start every, or as much as possible, start our decision making with what are the biases I'm bringing to this, that's the big step. The second step is to watch ourselves in action, to put a flashlight on ourselves, to say, are there patterns in my behavior? Are there certain people who I tend to be more positive about? Other people I tend to be more negative about? Are there certain situations in which I'm more comfortable or less comfortable with people? Then we move to the third one, which is to recognize that in order to do that, we need to slow down a little bit, you know, to develop patterns of you know, almost like constructive pauses, a constructive uncertainty, I like to call it, you know, that we're not so sure of ourselves, maybe replacing some of our exclamation points with question marks, you know, and we can put patterns in place of that. And there are a few others, but there's certain things we could do individually. Then systemically, you know, we can realize that most bias is not going to be handled completely by somebody by themselves for the very reason you said, because first of all, we're unconscious about it. And secondly, because human beings have a remarkable capacity for hypocrisy. Most of us have a self-justifying mechanism in our mind. You notice I said us, not you. It's true for me like it is for anybody else. We find a way to justify that which is important. And as one of my favorite quotes is from John Kenneth Galbraith, the great economist, who once said that most human beings give a strongly held point of view and evidence to the contrary will quickly go about refuting the evidence. And so we will throw out evidence that and we can see this if so boldly right now in our political, you know, lives. I mean, how the same behavior carried out by this person because they agree with me is fine. But when that person does that exact same behavior or something almost exactly like it, it's abominable, you know, but we somehow justify that contradiction in our minds. So education is the first step in systemic application, you know, that we give people a baseline understanding of why this happens, how we think, how we make decisions. That's the first step. And again, the right kind of education. But let's say you've taken a training program and it's the best training you ever did. What are the chances if you don't have to do a performance review for 4 months, you're going to remember the stuff you learned? I mean, we all know the answer to that. You know, if you're lucky, 20% of people remember some of those things. So that comes the second step, which are how do we put in priming techniques, or to use the term that's very popular now in behavioral economics, nudges that help us remember the time we need it. So as an example, one of the things we've created here at Cook Ross is a series of performance support tools that we have in an app that people can have on their cell phone. And there are two little 2-minute video clips that are built around the talent management structure. So about a dozen different talent management areas. So let's say I'm going to do a performance review on you and you work for me. And before I go to do the performance reviews, I run to the restroom. And on my way back, I pull up this thing and I watch a 2-minute video. When you're doing a performance review, here are 5 or 6 things to remember that can help you reduce bias in your thing. And it brings back that training to the moment I need it. So this is incredibly helpful. We're finding that people have these reminders. And there are a number of other ways you could do the same thing, but these nudges that lead us towards behavior that's more bias resistant. Then the third aspect is looking at some of the structures and systems that we use. So how do we interview people? How do we recruit people? How do we decide who to give job assignments to? How do we decide who to suggest for promotion? You know, what are the practices that we use? So simple things in a lot of cases. For example, one of the things that we found when we're doing interviews is that if you send the main interview questions to people a few days before the interview, you'll sort out bias based on introversion and extroversion. Because a lot of times, particularly in American culture, we're completely hooked by extroverts, when introverts may just take a little bit more time to process. Their answers may, in fact, be better sometimes, but because we put an emphasis on who answers fast, we miss that. So it also helps people who, for English, English is a second language, so that they have a chance to, because they're translating in their minds, it makes it a little easier for them to flow. So we've identified, you know, in my book, Everyday Bias, there's 16 pages in the appendix of ideas like this that people can use systemically. And then the fourth intervention is accountability, that putting together accountability systems that help us identify where the breakdowns are occurring in the system. A lot of times with diversity and inclusion, we have one measurement, which is how many are there. But let's say, for example, that we have a goal of bringing in 40% women. And we could do a whole conversation about goal setting, too, with diversity, because I always think it's so funny that, you know, when we set talk about goals for diversity, the response you get sometimes is, oh, my God, are you talking about quotas? You know, and it's fascinating to me because I can't think of any serious business initiative that anybody's ever taken on that didn't have a number associated with it. And when we operate in business, we have quantifiable results we're looking for.
I know the term quota has become a third rail, and we're not going to get into a debate here about whether they're good or bad, but I do think Howard makes a key point about the importance of applying metrics and the same kind of strategic thinking to diversity that we do to other key performance indicators.
Laszlo Bock had some interesting insights from his time at Google. They're known for reinventing human resources. He broke down a couple kinds of biases and how their hiring practices were designed to help mitigate them.
Every single person has biases. And there's two forms of that. One is the kind you read about, you know, unconscious bias against a different race or ethnicity. The other kind are biases that are just a function of how our brains work. There's cognitive errors like recency bias. If you met somebody recently and had a good experience, you're going to think they're better than they actually are because that will weigh on you. By charging a separate group with making these hiring decisions, what happens is they're not exposed to all of these things. They're reduced to just looking at how good is this candidate? How do they look on paper? What happened in the interviews? And making a much more objective decision. When I was at Google, the way it worked was the people team formed kind of a check and balance on the background. They ran the process. And then I was involved at the very senior level at the final reviews for about half the hires in the company while I was there, the non-engineering hires. But the ownership really should be the people in the company because they should be running this stuff, not HR. And so hiring committees would be comprised of people who typically were a job level or two above the people they were hiring. So they were close enough to be familiar to the work, but not so close that they'd be working as peers with these people. They would also be people who would not supervise the people who are being hired, because again, you want that objectivity. And ideally, you want people who are actually interested and care about the process and committed to the company more generally, more than just being out for themselves. The other thing it does by having a separate hiring committee is it's far easier to actually monitor bias and quality of decision making, because instead of having to train, you know, every single manager in the business, you've got a much smaller group of hiring committees that you can just go to and say, like, look, this is what we're looking for now. In marketing, we suddenly want analytic people instead of creative people. So you don't have to retrain every single person in marketing to do this. You just go talk to the 5 or 10 or 20 people on marketing hiring committees.
Howard talked about how a third type of bias manifests, this time in the context of a corporate board. He gets to the questions that every business leader should be asking if they want to move away from bias-led decision-making to fostering a truly high-performance team.
We all have these biases that Daniel Kahneman, the great Nobel Prize winner, called anchoring biases. You know, so we have certain things we begin to look for. So we value certain organizations more than others. We value certain schools more than others. We value certain backgrounds more than others. And often those backgrounds reflect biases that intersect with race or gender. So if, for example, I put it in a different context. I know one organization that's a very successful organization. It was started by a guy in his garage many years ago now with his friends who are mostly guys he played ball with. And so over the years, athletes became, you know, the people they looked for. And they even had it written down at some point that they really, you know, they like people who play team sports because people who play team sports know how to collaborate and cooperate and da, da, da. But you've obviously eliminated a huge percentage of people when you do that, right? So similarly, I think where boards are concerned, we have certain people we're looking for, and those certain qualifications we have may miss people who are successful and might be contribute enormously, who come from different kinds of backgrounds. And then once we've chosen people, then of course the piece we talked about a little bit earlier, which is how do they interact? How included are they in the conversation? Are they in their interaction between each other? Are they part of the old boys network? Are they part of the in-group on the board? Do we bring them in because we have a mindset that we have to have some women, we have to have some people of color? Or do we really see them as providing value beyond their identity? And all of that has a lot to do with how we interact with them, both consciously and unconsciously.
What Howard is talking about there is moving from representation to something deeper. And that ties in well with what we'll be talking about next episode, fostering a culture of safety and inclusion.
The single biggest thing you can do to make your organization more inclusive is actually not on the hiring side. It's on the environment you create on the inside.
Group performance does not depend on how smart you are. Does not depend on how smart you are. It depends on how safe you are. Safety is the fundamental element of group performance.
I'm excited for that one.
Me too.
I'm Erin Essenmacher.
And I'm Ashley Marchand-Orm.
Thanks again to you, our audience, for listening to Future Fluency. Future Fluency is produced and edited by Bruno Falcon, with production support from Carrie Sheehan. Special thanks to Jeanette Woods. Future Fluency is a production of the National Association of Corporate Directors. For more information on NACD or to become a member, please visit nacdonline.org.